reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power at Grantham University. Now here's your host, Jason Forticola.
Today we'll be joined by Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Administrator Dr. Don Berwick, Common Cause President and CEO Bob Edgar, Maryland Democratic Party Chair Susan Turnbull, and AFGE shop stewards Brian Frayer, Lance Parcell, and Pete Kovac.
We've been joined by Dr. Don Berwick, the administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Dr. Berwick, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
Tell us a little bit about the Affordable Care Act. It's been talked about many times over in the press from someone who's sort of on the inside here. Tell us a little bit about what you see.
I keep thinking of the Affordable Care Act as a thrilling piece of legislation. It's clearly the most important step our country's taken toward the health care we want and need since probably Medicare and Medicaid themselves were passed back in the 1960s. It seems to me to be the nation's commitment to making sure that people can have access to the health care that they want and need, and that that care gets continually better. There's a lot of investment in quality and improvement of care and sustainability. We're headed off a cliff right now with the cost of health care, and we have to find the way to make American healthcare sustainable as a system while giving people all the care they want and need. And that's what this act's about to me.
The act gets a lot of press in terms of its overall perspective. But talk about what it means for the average working American who didn't have access to health coverage, who may now get that through the act.
It means two basic things. You can have care, and that care will get better. That's how it feels to me. Sort of phase one, phase two. The first part of that is you can get to care. We had close to 50 million Americans who don't have health insurance. 32 million now will under this law. Even those that do have health insurance are under the constant threat they could lose it. People with chronic illnesses could be denied coverage. Coverage could be rescinded. People with chronic illnesses who don't have insurance will have trouble finding it. Insurance companies would have been allowed not to issue policies. Young people, as they leave college and enter the workforce, can't get covered under their parents' policies. That's all changed now. So people under 26 can be covered under their parents' policies. Insurance companies progressively are forbidden from withholding coverage for people with chronic illness. Rescission is no longer going to be possible. There's subsidization through the insurance exchanges for people of marginal income to find help finding insurance. The exchanges themselves. So those of us who worry that we won't have insurance worry a lot less with this law. And by 2014, that will have kicked in completely. So that's just security for people. It also makes the trust fund last longer. Medicare trust funds under threat. It could go bankrupt. It's supposed to go away by 2017. That's been extended 12 years now, according to CBO, and we think they're in the Office of the Actuary. And I think we're going to see a much more durable Medicare system. So that's the care will be there for you. Point one. Point two is that care is going to be better. We have a very fragmented healthcare system. Ask someone with chronic illness. They get lost. They get dropped. The doctor doesn't. Two doctors don't talk to each other. They go in the hospital and go home, and they have to do it all over again. They have to keep repeating your name. See, we don't have coordinated care in this country. The new law has all sorts of resources now through government in partnership with the private sector, can help create much more sensible care for people, safer care, more continuous care. The care gets better, and that's the secret weapon against cost. Because like in every other product or service you use, defective service costs more than service that's done right. So make healthcare better, costs will fall.
So with any initiative or program, there are going to be detractors from that. And some of the detractors of this Affordable Care Act say, well, we have Medicare, we have Medicaid, we have, children's health insurance programs. What do you say in response to that? As an advocate of the Affordable Care Act.
Thank goodness we have Medicare and Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program. These are major commitments by our country that none of us want to go back on. But that isn't the same as making the care better under those programs. So ask a Medicare beneficiary today who has congestive heart failure and a little diabetes what her care is like, and she'll tell you, I'm worried. I get lost. They don't remember me. I have five doctors and five meds, and I'm not sure they all make sense. So, no, we have the coverage. Now we can make the care better. And as I said before, those who aren't in Medicare, not in Medicaid, and not in CHIP, those people who couldn't find coverage before because they have a chronic condition or they're just a little bit above the income limits for Medicaid, now they get help. And it's just better.
Talk about the need for Americans in general to stay healthy. Shed a little bit of light on that.
People can do so much to keep themselves healthy and to avoid the need for care. Nobody ever wanted to be in a hospital. Nobody ever wanted to see a doctor. You do that because something's wrong. But we can keep those things from going wrong. I'll give you an example. For heart attacks and strokes, four simple things can reduce the risk of heart attack and stroke profoundly. An aspirin a day for people in the right, a baby aspirin a day for people in the right age group. Don't smoke. If you check your blood pressure and get it under control if it's high. And if you have high cholesterol, take a cholesterol-lowering med and watch your diet. Cholesterol, blood pressure, smoking, and aspirin. That's pretty simple stuff. You would be, it's hard even to overestimate how much benefit there would be in reduction of heart attacks and strokes. Now, the new law, the Affordable Care Act, that's a lot about prevention. You know, when Medicare and Medicaid were passed, it didn't cover prevention, not even a checkup. Well, a few years ago, we added the Welcome to Medicare visit. That's a checkup now because of the new law. That visit's free, no cost, no copay, and you now have an annual physical with your doctor if you and your doctor want. That's covered. Preventive services are covered. Colonoscopy, mammography, for flu vaccine. So there's an opportunity here for people to keep themselves healthy. That's better for them, better for everybody else. And, by the way, it makes costs lower.
AFGE's Inside Government here with Dr. Don Berwick, administrator of CMS. We were talking about keeping people healthy. And why do you think that it is such a struggle for people to keep their hands around their own health?
Well, it's the normal day-to-day challenges we face. Let's first study the science. I mean, the one thing, people may think that health care keeps you healthy, but it doesn't. Only about 10% of your health status is determined by the health care you get. About half of it's determined by the genes you got, but then the rest of it, and you can do a lot for yourself no matter what genes you got, is your behaviors, choices you make. Do you smoke or not? Are you careful with your weight? Do you exercise? And then things in the environment around them, things like disparities, social disparities. As long as we have the burden of poverty in our country, poverty is bad for your health. And so these are outside causes. Each of them can be addressed. We can address smoking. We know, but it's hard to stop smoking. It can be done. We can address obesity, which is a major national plague, but it's hard to lose weight. But it can be done. It's an enterprise. What do you want to invest in? And disparities, social disparities. We need to close those gaps because that'll give us healthier babies and healthier mothers and longer lives.
So do you think as we progress and maybe with things like the Affordable Care Act, which really does help with prevention and things like that, that we can shift that, we can, you know, educate our people more about eating the right foods, getting enough exercise, not smoking?
Yeah, it's all of us together. It's all of us together. It's everybody getting invested in the kind of healthy society we want. From the CMS point of view, my colleagues there, 4,500 CMS employees, know that this year in our strategic plan, I've asked that we put prevention right there, you know, in the strategic plan. We're focusing this year on cardiovascular diseases, heart attacks and strokes with some of the preventive things we just talked about, but having CMS do everything we can to help support the search for prevention among clinicians, patients, communities. I also would like to be focusing on disparities in outcomes, especially right now. I'm a pediatrician. I take care of babies, so I'm really interested in perinatal outcomes, the birthing outcomes. In parts of our country, complications in infants and mothers are very high, and we can do something about that. CMS can do something about that in partnership with states and professional societies and patients.
And how is that going?
That part we're just kicking off, but I'm so excited about it. The work on heart attacks and strokes, we're doing that hand in glove with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Their brilliant leader, Tom Frieden, has laid out the science here and told us how to prevent heart attacks and strokes even better than I ever thought was possible. The Assistant Secretary for Health, Dr. Howard Koh, we meet with him absolutely regularly. My Chief of Staff, Kaya Lewis, is focused on prevention. I'm really excited about what we're going to do there. And by the way, when I talk to our staff in CMS, they're excited too. I can see people's eyes, they light up. They say, oh my goodness, we can save lives here. And we can. So it's going to go well.
Well, as we come into here to our last minute, give us your final thoughts. What do you see coming up in the years ahead?
Excitement. This year, the Affordable Care Act begins to get even more traction, offering people what they want, security and their coverage, and better care. It's a tremendous time in American medicine right now. I'm perplexed and disturbed by the misinformation about this. People have been made afraid. They shouldn't be afraid. This is a time of tremendous progress in healthcare, but we have to do it together. It's going to be government, CMS, the private sector, hospitals, doctors, insurers, and patients all deciding that we want to go for the care we really can have. It's never been a better time.
CMS Administrator Dr. Don Berwick, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Jay. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Common Cause President and CEO and former Congressman Bob Edgar. Welcome back to the program.
It's good to be with you.
So we have you here today at Families USA's Health Action 2011 conference in Washington. What have you seen so far that you've been impressed with?
Well, I was particularly impressed with Senator Tom Harkin, who I've known for years. Tom and I got elected in 1974 as part of the Watergate baby class. He was also followed by Senator Max Baucus. So Senator Harkin and Senator Baucus were instrumental in getting the health care legislation passed. Just to be clear, I'm on the board of Families USA. I also serve on the board of the National Coalition on Health Care. And we've been working really hard over the last few years to institute health care legislation that would cover more Americans that are outside the healthcare network. And this conference is a good example of where more than 800 people have come to talk about not only defending the bill, but talking about ways to improve the legislation that passed the Congress. It stumbled and fumbled its way into existence, primarily because the opposition to any kind of healthcare really used the legislative process to stall and delay, including issues like the filibuster, which blocked early passage of the health care bill and weakened it in several ways. But we think it's strong enough not only to survive the attacks that it's having, but it's important enough to include as many Americans as possible so that health care becomes a right, not simply something that's tacked on.
In terms of the Affordable Care Act, you mentioned some of the attacks that are being placed upon it. And, of course, you'd be referring to repeal efforts in the House of Representatives. What are your thoughts on that? And do you believe there's any real traction that's behind it?
Well, I think that the conservatives and the Republicans made a mistake in simply as their first act after the tragic shooting in Tucson to come onto the House floor and simply get their majority to vote for repeal, even though they knew it wasn't going to pass in the Senate and they knew the president would veto it if it did pass. I think they would have been better served to say, we have problems with the health care legislation. Here's our alternative. We're going to send that back to our committees that are now controlled by the Republicans, and we're going to work on a bipartisan, nonpartisan solution to this problem and that problem. What happened by coming on the floor and simply blasting the whole act, they forgot that senior citizens like the drug provision. They forgot that parents like the ability to keep their children on till age 26. They forgot that 20 million Americans are now going to have access to health care. And they forgot that small businesses are getting a subsidy for health care.
Some of those things are so important when talking about the bill, because that's what it is. That's what's in it. We've heard reports the bill might not be popular with some folks, but whenever you start to break it down, what's in it? You know, some of the things that you just mentioned, especially something like no longer being able to deny a patient because of a pre-existing condition. Those are pretty important things, and I think pretty powerful when you're talking about what's in the bill. This is what it is.
But I think your listeners know that illness strikes every family, every person sometime during their life. And whether you're a conservative or a liberal or a moderate, healthcare challenges facing all people and all families have to be addressed. And my guess is that the longer that this bill is in place, this law is in place, more and more people will recognize that the specific provisions of the bill are okay. There may be need to correct certain aspects of it moving down the line. But remember, when Social Security was passed, which now provides a floor under all of our senior adults, even with the latest depression and economic trauma, you don't see senior citizens lining up to get food and help because they at least have a base of help. Social Security passed with all kinds of glitches and all kinds of opposition. But over the years, it was refined, it was improved, the quality of the service was given. I think the same thing's going to happen with health care. And you make a really good point about pre-existing conditions. If you have a pre-existing condition and are denied by a health insurer, you're going to say, why doesn't Congress fix it? And they did.
What are some other things that people can look forward to either in the short term or, say, when the majority of the reforms are rolled out in 2014?
Well, I think the biggest benefit is that the cost of health care will actually go down. You won't have insurance companies upping the price all the time. We pay for the health care of the 40 to 50 million Americans who have no health care because when they get sick or are in an accident, they're treated at the emergency ward regardless of whether they can pay, and the extra cost is put on the health care of everyone else. If you have a system where everybody is contributing something and all businesses are covering their employees, then that spreads the cost across the whole of our society rather than just the handful of people who can afford to pay for health care today.
One of the things that you mentioned earlier was filibustering in the Senate. And I know that's something that's very important to Common Cause, and I think something you'll probably be working on quite a bit in 2011. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. I mentioned that in the Senate, in the last 4 years, 70% of the legislation coming to the Senate has either been blocked or slowed by the use of the filibuster. In order to even bring a bill to the floor, you need 60 votes. And in the past, the onus has been on the 60. In the last few days, with the help of Senator Harkin and Senator Udall and several senators who know that reform needs to take place, we were trying to get the Senate to modify their rules just in a minor way. First, to stop filibustering at the front end of the process, filibuster at the end of the process after the amendments and bill has been thoroughly debated. And secondly, if a filibuster is called, have the 40 senators who 41 senators who blocked the legislation, have them stay on the floor, the so-called talking filibuster, much like you saw Jimmy Stewart in 1939. You'll be interested to know there were zero filibusters when Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, the movie, was there. In the whole of the Eisenhower administration, there were two filibusters. And if you study the history of it, the filibuster's been used more often to support lynching laws, segregation, and slavery. It's rarely been used by progressives on things like civil and human rights. It's not in the Constitution, and what Common Cause is prepared to do is if the Senate isn't willing voluntarily to change and modify its rules, we believe that there's an argument in the federal court, so we're willing to challenge the constitutionality of the filibuster. While the Constitution says the House and Senate has the right to set their own rules, several cases throughout history where the courts have stepped in and said, while that's true, you don't have the right to set rules that are unconstitutional. So we're going to argue, and hopefully the constitutional lawyers who often become judges, if they look at the arguments that we have presented, we believe that we can argue successfully in the courts, if nothing else, to start a national debate. Should every church, should every synagogue, should every mosque, should every homeowners association, should every legislative body have to have a supermajority? The good news is our founding fathers were pretty smart. They put six instances in the Constitution for a supermajority. If you want to impeach the president, you need a supermajority. If you want a trade bill, you need a secret supermajority. If you want an amendment to the Constitution, on all other issues in the Federalist Papers, they intended that democracy would be based on majority rule. All of English common law believes that. We're the only country where one of the legislative bodies can hold up everything by a supermajority on every action. We think that's got to end.
One of the other things I know that you're pretty into is the idea of campaign finance reform, right? And sort of trying to take money out of politics, right, not put money into politics. Could you expand upon that a little bit?
Yeah, let me just say, when I served in Congress for 12 years, money was important, but the special interests would come to our offices and bring their talking points first, and then they would see how we voted. And if they liked you, they would support you with legal contributions through political action committees. If they disliked your voting record, they didn't bother you at all. They were out simply trying to get somebody to defeat you using the legal political action committee system, which limited the amount of money that could be put in. Because of Citizens United, the Supreme Court case that passed by a 5-4 decision, corporations and labor unions are now able to dip into their corporate treasuries and spend independent money for and against candidates. And we believe that this is going to have a terrible effect on the presidential campaign coming up in 2012. So we're working on not only campaign finance reform, but working to bring to public's light those conservatives like Charles and David Koch, who have brought major businesses together to try to shift Congress and the Senate towards corporate interest rather than public interest. And we want to expose both on the far left and the far right the amount of money that's spent. When I ran for the United States Senate, I ran against Arlen Specter. We had a great campaign. He raised $6 million. I raised $2 million. In Pennsylvania, just 3 years ago, the two candidates raised $37.5 million, most of that from special interest groups. Even before the Citizens United case opened up the swell of funds, too much money was spent in campaigns. And we believe that if we don't do something to stop the corporate invasion of our politics, we're going to have a Congress that is owned by corporations and not owned by voters.
Bob Edgar, President and CEO of Common Cause. Congressman, as always, thank you for your time and your insight.
Great to be with you.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Some polls say Americans don't trust government. But listen to our members, the real people who work hard for you every day.
I'm Mike Schnobrick, a correctional officer at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. Trust me, the terrorists are locked down tight.
My name is Janet Winghart, a Social Security claims rep in Fort Lauderdale. Senior citizens can trust me to get them the right check at the right time.
I'm Michelle Reed, a registered nurse at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. Trust me, I care for our veterans like family.
My name is Everett Kelly. I work for the Anniston Army Depot, Anniston, Alabama. Trust me, our tanks are tough.
I'm John Gage, president of AFGE. You can trust us. We work for you. Brought to you by AFGE and online at afge.org.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Susan Turnbull, the Maryland Democratic State Chairman. Welcome back to the program.
Good to be here.
So we've got you here today at Families USA's Health Action 2011 Conference. Tell us a little bit about what you've seen so far.
Well, I've seen a lot of excitement. And basically, people are saying, we are not going to give up the gains that we made. We are going to move forward, not backwards.
So talk about that a little bit. Now, I think you're referring to the Affordable Care Act and some interest on Capitol Hill by certain people who want to repeal that.
Right. Actually, in the House of Representatives, the Republican majority did vote 100% on the Republican side to repeal the Affordable Health Care Act. And what that is really a major show of hypocrisy, because there is, and it is style, not substance. What they are saying, in fact, is that we're going to move backwards, knowing full well that that bill is not going to gain traction in the United States Senate, and Barack Obama, our president, would veto that legislation.
So what then is the reason for calling for a repeal?
Style. It's all style, and it's ridiculous, because basically what they are not saying, and unfortunately for the Democratic perspective and for those who care about making sure that people have access to health care, that that there is preventive health care, that we are dealing with the issue of the donut hole for prescription drugs and making them affordable, that we are making sure that people who are up to 26 years old can be covered on their family health care plan. All of these things are things that basically the Republicans know are popular items, and they don't talk about. What they talk about are minuscule facts that actually President Obama stated just the other night in the State of the Union address, that paperwork things can be fixed. But the major guts of this program, things that are making sure that people who have pre-existing conditions are covered, and basically giving the nation the opportunities for health care that members of Congress have themselves.
That's a pretty important point there, you know, to sort of open up access for everyone to have the same care,
right,
or access to the same care.
Exactly. It is hypocrisy, because basically, if you are a member of Congress, you have immediate health care. It is also the case that the coverage that members of Congress and their families have allow them, allow people with pre-existing conditions to be covered. And what we've done here with the bill last year is our new law gives levels the playing field and makes those abilities available to everyone.
Now, as we've talked to people throughout the day today about the Affordable Care Act and the perception of it, you find that maybe from a 30,000-foot view, when someone is asked of the Affordable Care Act, they say they don't really know much about it. Maybe the reception is lukewarm. Some people may even say they don't like it. But when you start to point out the individual aspects of the Affordable Care Act, they respond favorably to it.
When you have an unemployment rate the way that we have, we know that there are people coming out of college, there are people coming out of high school who then get to a point where they don't have a job. They don't have health care insurance. And this gives them that, this in two ways. One, if the employer has more than 50 employees, they're now covered. Or they can be covered under their parents' plan. And that is something I know in my own family. I've talked about this before, even at this conference, about I have two sons, and one was an AmeriCorps volunteer and for a couple of years. And then when he decided to move back to Washington, he was working in a restaurant. He didn't have health coverage. And then he went to work, and so he bought a Cobra at a very, very high cost, went off and worked at a summer camp, and stepped on a rusty nail. I mean, those are things that happen. Things happen to people.
And those things aren't because of lack of responsibility or making poor choices. Sometimes in life, things just happen, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, for example, we were talking before we were on the air about the terrible weather. I mean, trees were falling on cars. I mean, you don't know what's going to happen. And people should have the ability to know they're not one step away, one accident, one illness away from economic insecurity.
And if I'm not mistaken, that a lot of times in this country, the economic insecurity or bankruptcy or what have you comes from a catastrophic medical event that wipes you out.
It's very interesting. Elizabeth Warren, who's well known for her work on financial reform, actually wrote a book on that subject a few years ago. First of all, people get used to, particularly in dual family income, dual income families, they're used to living a lifestyle that is recognizing that you need two cars, you need all of these things. If someone gets ill, then you still have those two car payments. You still have all of those things, and you may not have that job supporting all of your pre-existing conditions.
So where do we go from here, and how do we keep the Affordable Care Act in its current state and maybe even enhance it in some way?
Well, I think we need to make sure that the Senate does stay firm, that our senators do hold the line on this, and that we do make the necessary minor changes, the cosmetic changes in some respects, to the act, so that there is the ability to clear up the misconceptions. But I think our senators are very well versed on this legislation at this point because it took so long and they worked so hard. So I think people generally will make sure that people understand. You don't want to say to those, particularly to a senior citizen who has had a huge problem with prescription drugs, that, okay, we sent you a $250 check last year to make up for some of those costs. And starting in 2011, what you're doing is prescription drugs are 50% the cost that they were a year ago, and it's going to go even lower as we move on in time till 2020. Does Congress, do members of the Senate really want to go and say to senior citizens, sorry, we're taking it all back?
Let's shift gears for a minute and talk a little bit about what you have going on in the state of Maryland. Obviously, you're the state Democratic chairman, and you're working towards a lot of initiatives there. Go through some of those things.
Okay. The state of Maryland is really in great hands with our wonderful leadership with Governor Martin O'Malley, who was recently reelected on my birthday, November 2nd, with a very strong, strong margin. And he was elected largely with the support of the men and women of organized labor who were there with him. Obviously, like every other state, our state has serious economic issues, but even in difficult times, our governor has shown that he has made the tough choices to move us forward. That's why we have the number one school system in the nation, public school system, named 3 years in a row, which is the first time that's ever been done by Education Week magazine. We're one of 8 states in the nation that still has a AAA bond rating. And the governor is introducing new plans for investment for small business. We're very excited about the direction our state's taken.
So we know, obviously, that you're very active in your state and in your community. What have you seen with the Affordable Care Act changing maybe in your community? What has the response been from people who live in your community who now may be able to take advantage of some of those things?
Well, Maryland has been ahead of the curve. Prior to the Affordable Care Act being passed, actually with the help of someone who has been very active with Families USA, Vinnie DeMarco, The Maryland Health Coalition, working with us, has put more than 200,000 new people on the insurance rolls. Half of that number are children who had not had care before. So we have moved it. While the nation is adding 32 million people to the ability to have accessible insurance. Maryland had already made that step, and we know that those numbers are going to increase significantly in Maryland because of the federal act.
And what does that mean for a working family? I think sometimes the rhetoric that we hear on the news and the television
basically,
is...
Well, the other thing that is part of it is that the Affordable Health Care Act allows preventive health care. So there's two things. For a family where you have grandparents and you're worried about, from that standpoint, first of all, for a senior, it allows them a well check, a check where they could go in and work on things and see what they need to be doing. So that's particularly helpful because of onset of diabetes frequently and older people. For everyone, there's preventive health care allowing tobacco cessation programs. And tobacco cessation programs are things that affect all sorts of ailments that could be possible. So right off, you've got that happening.
So those are some very real, tangible things that working families, not only in the state of Maryland, but nationwide, can take advantage of, that they can use, that are available to them.
And most importantly, what's really, in Maryland, we're so proud because... Senator Mikulski championed the benefits that were necessary to bring gender equality. Being pregnant was a pre-existing condition in many states across this country. In 8 states, if you had been a victim of domestic violence, that was a pre-existing condition, and you were not able to have portable health care. Some of the additional provisions, the ability to have a mammogram, have that covered with a lower copay. The same thing with other testing and screenings. Those are things that are really important. And the ability to see your own doctor to have some of these tests.
So as we come into our last minute here, what can we expect from the Maryland Democratic Party in the years ahead?
Well, we're going to be supporting these progressive and strong elected leaders. Our next election is 2012, and our congressional delegation is up. Senator Ben Cardin will be up for reelection, and we're going to be working as hard as we can to make sure that he's reelected.
Susan Turnbull, Maryland Democratic State Chair, thank you very much for your time. Always great to have you on the program.
Great to be with you, Jason.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by 3 AFGE members, federal police officers. We have Brian Freyer from Local 1401, Lance Parcell from Local 1101, and Pete
Kovac from Local 2302. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So we're going to get a unique perspective from you three today on what it's like to be a federal police officer. Brian, let's start with you and talk about what you do and where you're from.
Basically, I'm with Joint Base Andrews out of Maryland. I'm a federal police officer there with the Department of Defense, Department of Air Force. Our job title as a police officer is 0083 series per OPM. And basically what we do is we do base law enforcement, the security of the base. We do gates, law enforcement patrols, security aspect for any flights coming in and out. Especially with Joint Base Andrews, we have a little bit different mission because we are the president's base. That's where Air Force One is kept.
And Mr. Parcell, you?
I'm out of Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson up in Alaska. We have an interesting perspective up there, being that it's Air Force led, but we also have the Army. We have a lot of different issues the Air Force hasn't quite dealt with in the past with the Army. A couple infantry battalions up there, so police work is the same as the locals do out in town, but a little bit different perspective of how we have to do it.
And Mr. Kovac, you?
I'm out of Fort Knox, Kentucky, Department of the Army police officer. We're an ever-growing and changing installation now. We were hit by BRAC. We used to be home of the armor. Now we're Human Resources Command. So our dynamics on the post are changing. We just got our first infantry unit about a year ago. So our perspective on law enforcement has changed, and the job that we're doing, it's ever evolving day to day.
Now, as I understand it, in the federal government, there are different classifications for law enforcement officers, and not every position is treated equally.
Well, they're not a different classification, Lance. Across the board, federal police officer, we're 0083 series. Capitol Police, Park Police, Pentagon Police, or Pentagon Force Protection Police, we're all the same series police officer. However, the Department of Defense, the Army, Air Force, Marine Corps, and the Navy, we are not equal to the other 083 series police officers.
And why is that? Why don't you have the same rights?
In my perspective, it's politics. In another perspective, it's statutory powers of arrest. We don't have statutory power of arrest. Our authority right now comes from our base commander.
A lot of it is semantics. I think a lot of people are fearful of the civilian police officers on base going out in town and imposing martial law, and that is by far what we do not want to do. We have no desire or need to go out in the local communities to do police work. We have enough work of our own on post to deal with. Our job is to provide protection to the base communities. However, that said, there's stuff that happens outside our gates that we can help with that we are prohibited from just because of the statutory issues.
Let's talk about some of those things. Give me some specific examples of incidents where you could assist, where you're not permitted to.
I'll give you an example. Just recently at a base, there was a major accident out on the highway, fatal. There was a fatal, and there was a someone that was in the process of dying. The base has a fire department that has a mutual aid, so they were out there and able to go out there and assist. The nearest trooper was about 50 miles away and was requesting help from that post of the civilian police officers to go out there and assist. By our powers, we were unable to do anything, so the firefighters were out there on their own dealing with the traffic and trying to deal with that issue without any assistance from law enforcement whatsoever. When there's 10 plus police officers right out inside that installation, trained and willing to help, but we're not allowed to.
At some point, you would think that common sense or just good judgment would take over, right?
Well, you know, people are worried about the looks. You know, there's so much, and I hate going into it, it's the Posse Comitatus Act, and, you know, that's a whole other argument that we don't want to get into. We're trying to get the powers here so we can go out and just do assistance. We're not out there to round up people, but, you know, why not have the first responders that are trained out there helping and assisting, especially when it's requested?
And it's not only the public safety issue like Lance just spoke about. And that incident actually was at a rural base. So without the law enforcement around to be able to respond and being 50 miles away, when you have 10 other officers there, that's a public safety issue. That's a huge issue. But the other issue, it's an officer safety issue also. The area that I work in, Prince George's County, I mean, I think most people are familiar with the homicide rate this year. It's January has been a huge, huge homicide rate. For a while there, it was one a day. And in the area of our base, at Joint Base Andrews. Now, if there's a police officer out there in a traffic stop and he's getting shot or shot at, we can stand there at the gate, can't help him. There's nothing, or even an employee at the red lights just before you come into our base. Like I said, the area that I'm in, it's a high crime area. There's nothing we can do to help a federal employee that's coming into base if they're being carjacked. There's nothing that we can do about it. There's no other police officers around. Just stand there and watch.
You have to just let it happen. By law, you have to let it happen.
You have to watch it. Yep. I mean, what public perception, what does that do? You know, I was told by a commander that our obligation, we're not obligated to do anything when we're there. I mean, we have officers that are wearing the uniform, and they're told that if you're not armed up, then you have no obligation to respond or do anything. And how's that going to go over with the public? You got a police officer sitting there watching and doing nothing, and they know you're a police officer, but you're just sitting there watching. Our hands are tied.
It opens up the officers themselves to liability issues. And it's someone that I know out on the street could see me driving across or driving by an accident, and I would have to wear my uniforms to work and back. I don't have a firearm that I can carry to protect myself if something happens. But if someone sees me drive by the accident, hey, I know that officer from the base. He didn't stop to help those people. That turns into a liability issue to us.
Now, Pete, are you having the same kinds of frustrations where you're located as well?
Yes, we are. I think this issue is at every base. It's not one base specific. You know, all we're asking is that we're federal police officers. Please treat us as a federal police officer. You know, we're not at the whim of the commanding general. We don't want to be that. We want to be our own. We want to be able to do what it is that you hired us to do. Don't handicap us in our jobs. You know, we've had the Fort Hood incident. You know, two civilian police officers, Munley and Todd, they're the ones that took that man out. Yet, they're not recognized as a federal police officer. You know, they were willing to give their life. The only time that they would have been recognized as that federal police officer is when their name went on that wall at the law enforcement memorial. And that's not right.
Now, that brings me to where we are today. Obviously, at AFGE's annual legislative conference here in Washington, what are your plans to go up to the Hill and make your case to members of Congress?
Well, like I stated before, I was able to sit down with Congressman Filner back in the middle of January. I was able to talk to his staff to get him to reintroduce H.R. 324. A lot of people know it as H.R. 675. It's now H.R. 324. And what that does is that's going to amend Title 10 of the United States Code to give us our statutory powers of arrest. That will make us equal, well, almost equal to our federal counterparts that are also in the same 0083 series. So what we're doing right now is we have a big push. It's time that we as DOD officers and AFGE together recognize what we are and do this push. It's 10 years. It's time to get it done. It's been long enough. So what we've done is we started a petition that's going around right now. It's here at the conference. It's for H.R. 324. If anybody out there listening to the program would like a copy of that petition to gather their own signatures, they can contact me at brianfrayer.gmail.com, and that's going to be brianfrayer@gmail.com.
Talk about the support that you've received on Capitol Hill on this issue and in your local communities as well.
I think Congressman Filner has been, as the DOD police officers, has been our biggest ally. Like I said, every single year for 10 years, he's introduced a bill for us. The one that just was recently signed by President Obama in October of last year was the LEOSA amendments. And this is a law that was supposed to be specific to DOD police officers. However, the Department of Defense is refusing to recognize it and says that this law does not apply to us.
And it's all due to the semantics of statutory powers of arrest. And that's all we're trying to get the equality that everyone else has so we as officers can protect ourselves.
It's basically what the definition of is.
So when you are in a situation on your base where you see something happen and you're not allowed to do anything, what's going through your mind?
Pain and anguish. It tears us apart because we chose this job, this profession, because we wanted to help people. And seeing something that's going on and knowing that you can't help, it tears us apart.
It seems almost counter to what you're there for, why you've chosen the career path that you have.
It is.
We have to enforce the same laws and regulations, but yet certain things are picked and choosed of what they want to deal with.
Yeah, we have to do selective enforcement because at the whim, the base commander can actually come down and say, hey, you're not going to arrest that guy today. And then tomorrow he may have somebody else. Yeah, you know what? Even though the same thing happened yesterday, today we're going to arrest this guy.
It sounds very subjective.
Yeah, it is. And for public relations for the military and DOD wide, you know, how can you explain to somebody that was just assaulted right outside the gate and they know that there was two officers, however many, standing there just watching, that, you know, how is the DOD going to counteract that one? You know, you had people that were there that could have helped, and now my child, my son, my daughter is dead or they're severely injured, and your guys did absolutely nothing. I thought the military was here to help and protect this country. You did not do it. You failed.
Right, and telling someone in that situation that, well, by law, we're not allowed to assist doesn't really make sense.
They don't care about the law. They expect a police officer. When they see a police officer, when they see us in our uniform, they expect help from us, and that's what we try to do. And you can't explain to them in any words, I'm not allowed to. That's just not right.
All right, and people don't care. The uniform's the uniform. It don't matter what patch or badge you wear. They just see a uniform.
And they expect.
Yep, and they expect police to help.
A police officer is a police officer is a police officer. You know, and like I can't stress enough what Lance said, is we are not trying to go outside the gates to do law enforcement. We want to be able to do our job on the base. But at the same time, I think as a public safety issue, if there is something outside the gate that we see, there should be something there where we can help.
You can't always count on the locals. They're busy themselves. They have their own issues, and they do help, and we appreciate it. But there's times at 30, 40 an hour that we're waiting for them to show up because they have higher priorities.
And maybe facing staffing issues like many of the rest of them.
And it's manning. You know, they're having to take time from their job to help us out. Why? You know, now you've just tied up two patrols on one case where all you needed was one person to take care of it. You know, financially, it's crazy. Law enforcement overall, monetarily, they're suffering.
And I think that's something else that that people don't realize is we don't book our subjects in the jail. We have to call the locals to come, if they're available even, to come on base. So there's
time release.
Yeah, there's times we have to let DUI drivers go. There's times we have to let a suspect from a major domestic violence case go because either the locals don't have the time to come and help us or we just can't do it. Our hands are tied by the base commander.
Well, we appreciate your time today, and we're certainly going to keep an eye on this in the future and hope that maybe you can come and update us after you go and speak to your members of Congress on the Hill.
I appreciate you having us on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to our guests this week, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Administrator Dr. Don Berwick, Common Cause President and CEO Bob Edgar, Maryland Democratic Party Chair Susan Turnbull, and AFGE Shop Stewards Brian Freyer, Lance Parcell, and Pete Kovac. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and Grantham University.